In 2005, Richard Layard's Happiness sparked a revolution in how we think about well-being. The book arrived at a crucial moment when Western societies were questioning why decades of unprecedented wealth hadn't delivered promised happiness. Oprah Winfrey featured it in her influential book club, calling it the book that finally explained why money can't buy happiness. The work has influenced policy in countries from Britain to Bhutan, where the government famously prioritizes gross national happiness over GDP. Layard, an economist with an unusual interest in psychology, broke academic boundaries by synthesizing research from multiple disciplines into a coherent philosophy of happiness. As mental health has become a global crisis, the book's insights have only grown more relevant, perhaps explaining why Bill Gates included it in his 2023 list of books that made me think differently about happiness. There's a devastating paradox at the heart of modern life. Despite becoming twice as wealthy over the past 50 years, people in Western societies aren't any happier. Scientific research confirms this troubling fact. Happiness levels have remained flat across the United States, Britain, and Japan despite dramatic economic growth. We enjoy better health, more comfortable homes, shorter working hours, and unprecedented technological conveniences. From smartphones that connect us instantly to the world to smart homes that automate our daily tasks. Yet our collective well-being hasn't improved. This paradox demands explanation. If money doesn't buy happiness beyond a certain point, research suggests around $75,000 annually in the U.S., what does? The answer requires understanding the true nature of happiness and its causes, which proves far more complex than simple economic metrics suggest. Happiness isn't merely subjective. It's an objective, measurable feeling that corresponds to specific brain activity. When people experience positive feelings, electrical activity increases in the left front of the brain. Negative feelings activate the right side. These patterns can be verified through brain scans and EEG measurements, confirming what people report about their own happiness levels. Recent studies using fMRI technology have identified specific neural circuits associated with different types of happiness, from the immediate pleasure of eating chocolate to the deeper satisfaction of meaningful social connections. Happy people generally have stronger immune systems, lower stress hormones, and recover better from surgery. Studies show they have up to 50% lower levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, and significantly higher levels of immune-boosting antibodies. Even momentary happiness improves body chemistry, while significant positive experiences, like winning an Oscar, can add years to one's life. Research suggests Academy Award winners live an average of 4 years longer than nominees who don't win. Our feelings aren't just psychological states, they're fundamental biological signals that evolve to guide behavior towards survival and reproduction. What makes this paradox particularly troubling is that within any society, richer people consistently report being happier than poorer people, typically scoring 20 to 30% higher on happiness surveys. Yet as societies grow wealthier overall, average happiness doesn't increase. This suggests powerful psychological mechanisms are at work, canceling out the benefits of growing prosperity. Two key mechanisms explain this phenomenon: social comparison and habituation. We judge our financial situation not by absolute standards, but by comparing ourselves to others nearby, our neighbors, colleagues, and social media connections. When everyone's income rises together, the relative positions remain unchanged, and so does happiness. Additionally, we quickly adapt to material improvements, requiring ever more stimulation to maintain the same feeling, a hedonic treadmill that keeps us running just to stay in place. Studies show that lottery winners return to their baseline happiness levels within just 1 year of their windfall, demonstrating how quickly we adapt to even dramatic improvements in circumstances. What truly makes us happy? Research reveals 7 major factors that significantly influence happiness levels: family relationships, financial situation, work, community and friends, health, personal freedom, and personal values. family relationships consistently rank as the most important factor across studies. Marriage typically increases happiness for both genders, with the effect peaking around the wedding year, before slightly declining but remaining above pre-marriage levels. Divorce shows the opposite pattern. Happiness plummets and often takes years to recover, particularly for women. The quality of relationships matters most. People in loving relationships have better hormonal balance, better health, and greater happiness. Work provides not just income, but essential meaning to life by creating self-respect and social connections. Unemployment devastates happiness, primarily through the loss of purpose and identity rather than income loss. The pain doesn't diminish over time, even after years without work, and leaves psychological scars even after re-employment. For work to contribute to happiness, it must be fulfilling. Particularly important is having control over what you do. Community and friendships form another crucial pillar. As Epicurus noted, friendship may be the greatest contribution to lifelong happiness. The quality of community, social capital, profoundly affects our ability to make friends and feel safe. Trust levels vary dramatically between countries, from just 5% in Brazil to 64% in Norway, who believe most people can be trusted. Living where you can trust others significantly increases happiness. Health matters for happiness, though perhaps less than many would expect. People adapt remarkably well to many physical limitations, but never fully adapt to chronic pain or mental illness. This suggests that controlling suffering from within should be a top priority for increasing happiness. Personal freedom and government quality create the conditions for happiness to flourish. The West takes for granted two factors lacking in half the globe: personal freedom and peace. Countries with better rule of law, stability, accountability, and less corruption consistently show higher happiness levels. Finally, personal values and philosophy of life determine how we interpret and respond to life circumstances. People are happier when they appreciate what they have, avoid constant comparisons with others, and can regulate their moods. Those who care about others are generally happier than those preoccupied with themselves. More anxiety comes from striving to do well for yourself than from striving to do good for others. If health and wealth have improved over 50 years, what factors have worsened to offset these gains? The evidence points to deteriorating family relationships, community strength, and personal values. Family breakup has become dramatically more common since 1950. Only half of American 15-year-olds now live with their biological father, compared to two-thirds in Britain and Germany. Children living with only one biological parent by age 16 face alarming disadvantages: 70% higher likelihood of juvenile criminal conviction, twice the risk of dropping out of high school or teenage pregnancy, and 50% greater chance of unemployment at 20. Crime has risen enormously since World War II, reflecting massive alienation in parts of society and reducing victims' well-being and everyone's sense of security. The main rise in crime occurred between 1950-1980, with overall recorded crime increasing 300% in the U.S. and 500% in Britain. Though crime began declining in the U.S. in the early 1980s and in Britain around 1995, rates remain much higher than 50 years ago. Trust has declined dramatically. In 1959, 56% of Britons said most people could be trusted, falling to just 30% by 1998. Similarly, American trust levels dropped from 56% in the mid-1960s to 33%. Fewer Americans now belong to community associations, with each new generation beginning adult life at lower trust levels than previous ones. Television has played a significant role in these changes. The typical Briton watches TV for 3.5 hours daily, about 25 hours weekly, more time than spent in paid work over a lifetime. Television viewing time comes primarily at the expense of social interaction. A study of Canadian communities when TV was first introduced showed that social life declined, especially for older people, sports participation decreased, and creativity diminished among both young and old. Television's content significantly impacts our feelings and behavior. Unlike real life, TV focuses on extremes, showing excessive violence, sex, chaotic relationships, wealth, and beauty. This has dual effects. Violence and sex desensitize viewers, making them more willing to engage in similar behaviors themselves, while displays of wealth and beauty create discontent with what people have. The mind can be trained to control mood through disciplined practice. In an experiment by Jon Kabat-Zinn, workers who practiced meditation for 8 weeks showed remarkable improvements in happiness that persisted 4 months after the course ended. The participants also developed stronger immunity to flu after vaccination. We can train our feelings just as we train other skills. Developing a positive outlook requires discipline, but such disciplines exist and can be practiced. Like mastering the violin, which requires thousands of hours of practice and changes the brain's neural connections, we can learn skills for happiness through consistent practice. Buddhists believe the aim of life is happiness and avoiding suffering. Their approach involves eliminating negative thoughts by calmly observing them rather than suppressing them. When feeling anger, one notes it from a detached perspective so it no longer consumes us, treating it like a little baby rather than being controlled by it. While Buddhism is essentially psychological, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism involve relationship with God who is both within and outside us. Though these religions may be less explicit than Buddhism about managing feelings, all contain mystical traditions focused on achieving serenity. The last 30 years have seen a revolution in practical psychology. The Freudian focus on reliving past traumas has given way to forward-looking techniques. Aaron Beck's cognitive therapy breaks the vicious cycle of self-destructive automatic thoughts by teaching patients to challenge negative beliefs. The approach treats depression, anxiety, and panic attacks by having patients interrogate their catastrophic forecasts and test them through quasi-scientific experiments. It often incorporates behavioral therapy, committing to exercise or helping others, and is particularly effective for phobias and obsessive-compulsive disorder, unlike ineffective emotion venting therapies. Martin Seligman's positive psychology movement focuses on developing our strengths rather than wrestling with weaknesses. It emphasizes meaningful goals and authentic happiness sources. One key insight contrasts maximizers, who seek the best, with satisficers, content with what's good enough. Research shows maximizers, despite sometimes achieving better outcomes, are less happy because they experience more regrets and make more social comparisons. The human brain contains approximately 100 billion neurons, each connected to 1,000 or more others, creating a vast neural network of over 100 trillion connections. Messages travel electrically within neurons at speeds up to 268 miles per hour, then release chemical neurotransmitters that cross microscopic gaps called synapses to trigger electrical impulses in the next neuron. Different neural circuits utilize specific neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and GABA to perform distinct functions and generate different emotional and mental states. Depression is associated with too little serotonin, typically 40 to 60% lower among suicide victims, while schizophrenia is linked to excess dopamine activity in specific brain regions. Recreational stimulants like cocaine and amphetamines work by flooding synapses with dopamine, creating temporary euphoria, while sedatives like Valium and alcohol enhance GABA's natural role in slowing neural firing and reducing anxiety. This delicate chemical balance explains why even small changes in brain chemistry can dramatically affect mood and behavior. About a third of us will experience serious mental health problems in our lifetime, including schizophrenia, 1%, major depression, 15%, bipolar disorder / manic depression, 1%, and intense anxiety disorders, 18%. These conditions show strong hereditary patterns. Identical twins of schizophrenics have a 48% chance of developing it versus 17% for non-identical twins and just 1% in the general population. Similar genetic correlations exist for depression, 40% heritability, and anxiety disorders, proving their partial biological origin and explaining their responsiveness to medication. The 1950s witnessed four revolutionary psychiatric drug breakthroughs that transformed millions of lives and led to the deinstitutionalization movement. For schizophrenia, chlorpromazine reduced hallucinations and delusions by 70% in most patients. For depression, imipramine increased serotonin availability, lifting mood in 65 to 75% of cases. For manic depression, lithium became the first mood stabilizer, preventing both manic and depressive episodes in about 70% of patients. Unlike recreational substances, these medications produce lasting changes in brain function when taken regularly and don't create dependency or addiction. As psychiatric medications become more sophisticated and targeted, their use for mental health enhancement will likely increase, though legitimate concerns about side effects persist. For those with severe depression or anxiety, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs like Prozac, often create not personality change, but a restoration of natural temperament. Patients frequently report becoming more myself as positive personality traits emerge from under the shadow of illness. The relationship between mental illness and creativity has been extensively studied. Research confirms significant links between creative achievement and mood disorders. Artists and writers show 8 to 10 times higher rates of depression than the general population, and 38% of British artists surveyed reported seeking psychiatric treatment. However, when manic depressive artists take lithium, 80% report their creativity increased or remained stable while their quality of life improved. Studies suggest creative ability may stem more from genetic factors than from suffering itself, as relatives of manic depressives, sharing similar genes but fewer traumatic experiences, demonstrate higher creativity scores than both patients and control groups. Is cooperation possible in a world seemingly governed by Darwinian competition? While some human interactions are zero-sum games where one person's gain is another's loss, our better interactions are non-zero-sum, adding to our collective well-being. These cooperative ventures, distinct from market exchanges, involve pursuing common goals despite short-term personal sacrifice. From international climate agreements to local community projects, successful cooperation often requires participants to forego immediate benefits for long-term collective gains. The fundamental dilemma of cooperation is illustrated through a hunting scenario. Two people can either cooperate to catch more deer or attempt to cheat each other. When strangers who don't trust each other interact, both logically choose to cheat, resulting in poor outcomes for both. But when trust exists, cooperation becomes possible, yielding better results for everyone. This dynamic plays out daily in workplace teams, international diplomacy, and environmental conservation efforts. Consider how nations must cooperate on fishing quotas. While each country could benefit short-term from overfishing, collective restraint ensures sustainable stocks for all. Much good behavior occurs because bad behavior faces consequences. As Hobbes noted, courts enforce contracts and punish crime. While evidence shows conviction rates affect crime volumes, most moral action isn't motivated by fear of criminal law. Studies indicate that social sanctions, disapproval from peers, loss of status, exclusion from groups, often prove more effective deterrents than legal penalties. There must be voluntary mechanisms driving cooperation that produce decent outcomes for all parties, from informal community norms to professional codes of conduct. We value our reputation because others seek cooperative partners for win-win situations. This rational calculus leads us to be reliable and team-oriented. The tit-for-tat strategy, cooperate first, then mirror the other's previous action, proves most effective in repeated interactions. Business relationships, academic collaborations, and social networks all demonstrate how reputation-based cooperation creates lasting partnerships and mutual benefits. Even in online marketplaces, reputation systems enable cooperation between strangers. Moral behavior extends beyond rational calculation. By age 2, children comfort others who are hurt, sharing toys and showing empathy before understanding strategic benefits. We learn cooperation in families, driven by our desire for approval, not just for reputation, but from a deeper desire for harmony with those around us. Research in evolutionary psychology suggests we're hardwired for cooperation, with mirror neurons helping us understand and share others' emotions. Our sociability means we value good relationships not merely as means to other ends, but for their direct satisfaction. In our increasingly mobile world, cooperation relies more on our moral sense than on reputation. We help strangers we'll never meet again, return lost property, and donate to charities because of our deep sense of mutuality, treating others as we'd like to be treated. Studies of natural disasters reveal how people spontaneously cooperate in crises, sharing resources and helping others without expectation of return. This suggests that beyond calculated self-interest, humans possess an inherent capacity for cooperation that forms the foundation of successful societies. Jeremy Bentham, deeply troubled by the arbitrary and often cruel nature of 18th-century laws, proposed a revolutionary principle. All laws and moral rules should aim at producing the greatest possible happiness for the greatest number of people. This utilitarian principle holds that the right action is one that maximizes overall happiness, with each person's happiness counting equally in the calculation. While this idea has inspired numerous social reforms, from prison reform to animal welfare laws, modern society struggles to find a unified philosophical foundation for policy decisions and moral judgments. Happiness stands as the ultimate societal goal because it possesses a unique quality. It is intrinsically valuable. Unlike other objectives that frequently conflict with each other, happiness is self-evidently good and requires no further justification. The American Declaration of Independence recognizes this in its assertion of the right to pursue happiness as fundamental and self-evident. When we ask why happiness matters, we reach a philosophical bedrock. It simply does matter in a way that needs no further explanation. Other commonly pursued goods, health, autonomy, freedom, wealth, education, are instrumental values, meaning we value them primarily because they contribute to happiness. This hierarchical relationship explains why societies sometimes make careful trade-offs, such as restricting individual freedoms to enhance collective security, or limiting economic growth to protect environmental well-being. Modern empirical research, including advances in psychology and neuroscience, is increasingly revealing the concrete conditions that influence human happiness, helping policymakers avoid paternalistic assumptions when designing interventions. Critics of the greatest happiness principle often express concern that it might encourage passive pleasure-seeking or hedonistic behavior. However, psychological research shows that humans naturally gravitate toward challenging goals that provide meaning and purpose. A psychologically healthy person typically chooses goals whose pursuit brings inherent satisfaction, whether in career, relationships, or personal development. Those who fail to set meaningful challenges often experience depression and loss of purpose. The principle should guide not only public policy, but also individual ethical decisions. Our moral intuitions and rules weren't created by philosophers in ivory towers, but evolved through millennia of genetic and cultural evolution, resulting in widespread principles about promise-keeping, honesty, and consideration for others. These evolved moral intuitions generally align with promoting collective happiness. When confronting ethical dilemmas, whether choosing between competing family obligations, weighing career options, or deciding how to allocate charitable donations, the principle suggests considering the relative impact on all affected parties' happiness. For instance, when facing a conflict between attending a child's performance or visiting a sick parent, we should carefully weigh the emotional impact on each person involved. Our consideration of others' happiness stems from multiple sources: enlightened self-interest, expecting reciprocal consideration, genuine empathy and compassion, and rational moral principles. The concept of the impartial spectator, imagining how a neutral observer would view our actions, helps us approach difficult decisions with greater objectivity and leads naturally to giving equal weight to everyone's interests. This aligns with the ancient wisdom of the Golden Rule, found across cultures and religions: treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself. To create a happier society with less pressure and threat, we should monitor happiness as closely as income. This would fundamentally shift our perspective on public policy, recognizing that GDP growth alone doesn't guarantee well-being. We should reconsider taxation's role in work-life balance. Rather than viewing taxes as distorting the economy, we might see them as correcting the pollution of status-seeking. When someone improves their relative position through higher income, they lower others' relative position, creating an external cost not accounted for in markets. Progressive taxation can help tame this destructive rat race. Mental health deserves much greater priority. Despite mental illness causing nearly half of all disability people experience, the majority of mentally ill people receive no treatment. While mental illness accounts for a quarter of the total toll of disease, only 7% of U.S. health expenditures and 13% of British health expenditures target mental illness. Family-friendly work practices should become standard. The quality of family relationships consistently emerges as the strongest predictor of happiness, yet work often undermines family stability. Policy should recognize that producing children carries immense responsibility, with practical support including parenting education, family-friendly work hours, and high-quality affordable childcare. High unemployment must be eliminated through balanced, tough, and tender policies. Unemployment devastates happiness far beyond the income loss, creating a sense of uselessness that persists even years later. Successful approaches include welfare-to-work programs that balance rights to job offers with responsibilities to accept them. Advertising, particularly to children, should face greater restrictions. Advertising aims to change our values, making us feel we need things we previously didn't. Sweden's ban on commercial advertising directed at children under 12 offers a model other countries should consider. Most fundamentally, we need moral education that teaches empathy, emotional control, and service to others as established truths rather than discussion points. This education should provide a sense of purpose beyond self-interest, with a proper curriculum from early schooling through adulthood. Society cannot flourish without shared purpose. Pursuing self-realization alone creates stress and loneliness. We need the concept of common good, with the greatest happiness of all as our noblest goal, giving proper weight to both neighbors and self-interest. Having conquered material scarcity through science, we should rededicate society to happiness rather than efficiency.